All is well,
I think. Other than the fact that I'm going to mispronounce these names dreadfully.
I have not even... I was like, I don't even know.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous, infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul Carr.
How are you, Brian?
I'm doing great.
That's fantastic.
I have, you know, life is grand.
Yeah, life is grand.
There's a camper van Beethoven song somewhere in there, but we'll just carry on.
How often do you get a camper van Beethoven reference?
Not very often these days.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's what we bring to the podcasting universe.
That's right.
All right. Well, today on the program, we'll be discussing The Assassin's Road, the Dark Horse collection of the classic manga Lone Wolf and Cub by Kazuo Kiyoke and Gosuke Kojima. But first, I guess we have to mention that as we record this yesterday, Kazuo Kiyoke passed away.
Which is equally sad and a little strange.
Yes, it is. I called it a macabre coincidence on Twitter.
Yeah, did we do this to him? You know, because we announced that we were going to do this on our last podcast, so it's not like we're suddenly just, somebody died. We have to, talk about it.
Well, I had that weird thought go through my head. Was like, are people going to think we're trying to cash in on this man's death?
I think we're covered because, you know, we've got time stamped from the last podcast that we were doing
true.
This. So.
That's true.
And technically, since we were supposed to record last weekend, we would have actually had this out in time. And then we would have been prescient.
We should mention Kazuo Kiyoke is one of the Koike. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing his name wrong. I'm really bad at pronouncing names. I barely pronounce my own name correctly.
This is true.
I just want to say that. But he is...
I know what you mean, pal.
Thanks, Brain. He is one of the grandmasters of comic books. His influence has been felt far and wide in this industry. And his passing is... It's one of those things that's been happening quite a bit recently. We've been losing a lot of some great creators in the comic book industry recently.
And will continue to happen as, you know...
Well, yes, the inevitable passing of time.
But we're reaching that stage where a lot of the original, where a lot of the creators, it's happening in music, like rock and roll music and pop music now too, where we're just reaching that a certain time point where the people who became famous or who were influential in a time in which media started paying attention are now reaching certain ages.
Yeah, exactly. And there, and it's interesting. I don't know if interesting is the right word, but 6 months ago, I knew Kazuo Koike's name, and I knew who he was and what he did, but I didn't know his whole story and how influential he was, because I really haven't been that big of a fan of manga. But 6 months ago, I realized, hey, that's a gap in my comic book intelligence.
Right.
So I needed to learn more. And I've been reading a lot of the classics, including that's part of why we're doing this episode, because I've been reading so much manga recently.
Well, I think for the casual reader, not by casual reader, I don't mean, you know, we're comic book obsessives, you know, but generally, if we're being honest, our focus generally is in most cases on more Western culture oriented comic creation. So, you know, and most of our listeners and you and I as well, we've all read Lone Wolf and Cub because that's the one, you know, in terms of impact on outside of, you know, the more sort of Eastern style, you know, because of its influence, because Koke's influence on Frank Miller and other creators along those lines. And so we had those Dark Horse reissues, those little pocket-sized reissues going way back. Those may have started coming out when I was...
I'd say, were they coming out in the 80s or the
90s? I was much younger, yeah. I was buying... Well, it wasn't the pocket-sized ones. I picked up Lone Wolf and Cub along with my, you know, DC Batman comics at my local comic book store when I was in high school. And it was probably Dark Horse, but they were like the cardstock kind of larger size sort of deluxe format editions at that time. Yeah. So, but even as a high school kid in the 80s, I was reading Lone Wolf and Cub.
I was not. I read bits and pieces of it later when I was much older. But I never sat down and just got into it and just read all the way through.
Right.
Until recently. Because I realized that there's a gap in my knowledge. I mean, especially now, manga and anime are such a huge influence on film and pop culture that I realized that there was a gap in my knowledge and I needed to learn more about it.
Right.
I wanted to learn more about it.
Well,
but it's been very much, I mean, I've been reading a lot of it. That's, he's just been in the forefront of my mind recently. And then when I heard that he died yesterday, I just, I was kind of taken aback by it.
Yeah, I saw that. And, you know, that's when I, you know, sent you a message to us.
Yeah, that's what I woke up to. Thanks.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm a good helper.
But it's just, you know, we'll get into more about his writing and his influence as we do the episode. But it needed to be mentioned right off the top because it is a great loss to not only the comics community, but just to the, you know, to the arts in general.
Right. And I think, you know, we would have to put him up there with the Steve Ditkos.
Oh, absolutely.
Some of the other creators that you know, get a lot of attention, and when they die, it's like, oh, my childhood has, you know, this artist or this writer represented my childhood, my comic book reading sort of nadir. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, Lone Wolf and Cub, and, you know, this is up there.
I would compare them to
Lee Kirby. On par with Stan Lee? You know, yeah, I don't know.
I would put these two together. I would put them up with Lee and Lee Kirby. Completely different style, of course, and different influence, but that's how big they were and how influential they became. But we will get into that as we do the episode itself, you know, the main bulk of the episode itself. But first, before we get into that, last week was Star Wars Celebration, which was in Chicago, and Brian went, and it was really, you can tell us all about your experience there, Brian.
I went in cosplay. I went as Padme. No, I'm sorry. That's a lie. That is an absolute lie. I went as Slave Princess Leia.
Oh, I hope you took pictures.
Well, of course. I think they're all over, you know, the internet now. Yeah, I made sure to get that out there because I was really proud of my costume. Mm. I did not go. It looked like a lot of fun, but various events. I was actually out of town for the couple nights leading into it and had work responsibilities and other things. So, but I did, I was taking the train from Milwaukee back down to Chicago on the Thursday morning. And it was early in the morning. I think my train left at like 8 a.m. And I got to travel back to Chicago from Milwaukee with a nice little horde of cosplayers heading to the Star Wars convention. Turned out to be a lot of fun. They were very entertaining and were very excited to be heading into the city and to be attending the convention, and lots of stories that I got to listen in on. So it looked like it was a lot of fun, and it was nice to see the fans. Just in that brief interaction I had with them in the hour-long train ride it back into Chicago was kind of nice, and it reminded me of how much I love, for lack of a better word, geek culture, and just the culture of fandom, and how much fans, you know, enjoy expressing. You know, I'm pro cosplay, and I'm pro all of the things that come with fandom. And this was a nice example of seeing how this little corner of the world can give people an amount of happiness and also like a kinship with one another. So
yeah,
that was nice.
I love that. I go. We were talking before we started recording. about how I got to go to the Denver Comic Con. No, it's not the Comic Con anymore because they're not allowed to call it that. But I go every year. I don't cosplay myself, but I love the fact that people do.
Yeah, nobody wants to see me in cosplay.
Oh, a couple of years ago, I remember I was taking the train down, and it just so happened that the Denver Comic Con and the Rockies were happening. The Colorado Rockies baseball were playing on the same day at the same time. And as I was coming down on the train, there was a bunch of cosplayers and a bunch of people all dressed up in baseball outfits.
Which is the same thing.
I know. And I'm a huge baseball fan. So I was like, oh, look, people are cosplaying my two favorite things. But it was funny. It was everyone was getting along with each other. And, you know, it was just it was a neat little crowd. But what I wanted to get into was there was a couple of comic books released or announced at the Star Wars Celebration. So I thought I wanted to get your opinion on them, Brian.
Okay.
Okay. So first of all, what's that? Yes, you do.
I have opinions.
Yes, you do.
I have feelings.
So the major one, I guess, is that the main Star Wars title is going to be, the creative team is going to be replaced. So Kieran Gillen and Angel Unzueta. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Sure.
Sure.
Why not?
They're on the main Star Wars title. They'll be replaced by Greg Pak and Phil Noto. So what do you think about that new creative team?
Well, I think Star Wars, you know, the main Star Wars comic, it's should always, you know, change is good, right?
Yeah,
it's,
you know, it's,
Jason Aaron did a great run, but then Gian took over, and that was a great run. I don't love Greg Pak as the choice on this. Like, I like work that Greg Pak has done. You know, Planet Hulk and all of that was pretty phenomenal and a lot of fun. I'm just curious at the choice of Greg Pak as the primary writer, and maybe the Planet Hulk stuff and you know, maybe that has shown that he can tackle something more galactic.
Yeah, well, if Planet Hulk.
So I'm not going to condemn the choice before I read the work.
Yeah, like if Planet Hulk's any indication, he can do cosmic, you know, sci-fi oriented stuff.
Yeah.
So, and I don't mind Greg Pak. I think he's a workmanlike writer with occasional glimpses of brilliance. And
right.
So that's what I'm expecting from this run.
And yeah, Phil Noto's art, I think, is beautiful.
Oh yeah.
And his work on Poe Dameron, of course, amongst other things, but like keeping it within the Star Wars world. Was very affecting and very nice and worked well for that story. But, you know, because Noto uses sort of these sort of washed out colors and that's a big thing with him, and which works well. That's not washed out is not an insult, but when you're throwing him into like the big space epic, and you go from art that has these great, very detailed outer space battles, and sort of there's this darkness to what I look at is the coloring and the artwork. And Noto doesn't do that, or maybe he will.
Well, currently the art really pops. I mean, the darks and lights are really contrast each other and stand out. It makes a big visual spectacle when you read that comic. I think he's a freaking Eisner nominated artist.
And this is not a critique on Phil Noto as an artist, who I really like. I'm just wondering about. I'm curious to see how he approaches like the Star Wars world. And he's already had experience in the Star Wars world, but I'm curious to see how it translates into sort of the prime Star Wars comic.
Yeah. Is he going to adapt to
Is
he going to adapt his style to fit the universe that's been created?
It could be incredible.
Yeah.
You know, which I think that he is certainly capable of. That's, you know, again, it's none of this is a complaint. It is more of that's an odd pairing. I'm curious to see what happens.
Well, Pak at on he was on a panel where this was announced, And he said that it's going to be set between A New Hope and The Empire Strikes Back, because of course it is. God forbid we should get news stories. I'm sorry. That's letting my opinion show. But he said that...
We're in it for the long haul, Paul. Yeah.
So he said, here's a quote, you know the opening crawl of Empire when it mentions thousands of probes across the galaxy and we see only one probe? There are lots of other probes out there. 1,999. There were thousands of probes. And we're going to look and see what they're doing. So, okay.
Yeah.
That's an interesting premise.
It's an interesting take. So, yeah. You know.
And he also said that the storyline will split the central heroes across the original trilogy into three pairings, telling a different genre story. Luke and R2 will feature in a Western-inspired story. Okay. Han and Leia will have a noir-style tale that Pack characterized as smoky and sexy. Bomb chicka wow wow.
Bang chicka bang bang.
And of course, in my notes, I don't have what the third pairing is. So there's another one. But anyway, I think that's interesting. I do like how the current run kind of breaks off into different storylines and different characters, right. Different perspectives. And it looks like they're going to continue to do that. So, you know, I'm all for it. More Star Wars, please.
Yes.
Plus, I still want to go back and read old stuff like old manga comics, which we should probably talk about.
We should.
Perhaps we'll take a break.
Do and that after back. The break.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Lone Wolf and Cub.
Adventures into the unknown.
Tales from the crypt.
Skeleton hand.
The haunt of fear.
Dark shadows.
Vampirella.
The haunted tank.
The heap.
Eerie.
Swamp thing.
Weird mysteries.
Tomb of Dracula.
Tales of the unexpected.
Werewolf by night.
The demon.
Man thing.
Monster of Frankenstein.
Brother Voodoo.
The son of Satan.
Night Force.
The living mummy.
The Sandman.
Tomb of Darkness.
Evil Ernie.
Saga of the Swamp Thing.
Flinch.
Hellblazer.
30 Days of Night.
Preacher.
The Walking Dead.
What do these titles have in common? All of them. From Adventures into the Unknown, to Tales from the Crypt, to The House of Mystery, to The Tomb of Dracula, may be found in The Long Box of Darkness. I'm your host, Herman Lowe. Join me every Monday night for a journey into comic book horror as we delve into the secrets of the Long Box of Darkness.
So listen if you dare, puny mortals, to the Long Box of Darkness, available on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podbean. And check out the blog at www.longboxofdarkness.com. Good night. And pleasant screams.
And we're back. So, Paul. This podcast or this episode, we are dealing with your recommendation, which I believe we have already hinted at above. It's Lone Wolf and Cub. Would you like to tell us a little bit about it?
I sure would. Lone Wolf and Cub is a manga series that began in 1970 from writer Kazuo Kiyoke and artist Gosuke Kojima, who together are known as the Golden Duo. The series is recognized as one of the most influential and groundbreaking works of manga and comics in general. It's been spun off into 6 films, 4 plays, and a television series. Not to mention 28 volumes of collected editions. Starting in the 2000s, Dark Horse began releasing English versions in trade paperbacks, and today we are discussing Volume 1 of those collections, The Assassin's Road. The story follows Ogami Ito, a former Shogun's executioner who, after the murder of his wife and being accused falsely of treason, becomes a Ronin and sets off on a journey of discovery and vengeance, accompanied by his three-year-old son, just to make things interesting. And the two become known as Lone Wolf and Cub. Told in 9 vignettes, we see Wolf and Cub as they act as vigilantes, hired protectors, and assassins, all the while following a strict but sometimes morally fluent code. These tales are told in close, quiet, intimate ways that suddenly explode in kinetic violence, that's rendered in stark black and white, and a cinematic style that is both beautiful and disturbing to look at. The Assassin's Road is deceptively simple in the stories it tells. It hides beneath its surface a complex, multi-layered exploration of human nature, brutality, and surprising tenderness, with no clear answer to what is right and wrong. Brian, what did you think of The Assassin's Road?
Well, I think you covered everything, so thanks for
having me. Okay, so we're done, everybody. Thanks for listening.
No, I mean, clearly this is a monumental work, and it will be difficult to me to say anything negative about the work itself. Right. So it was very interesting. Like, I haven't read Lone Wolf and Cub in a good while. I think we often, that's our gateway to a lot of our episodes is, I haven't read this in a while.
Well, it's so interesting to go back and reread things.
Yes, and that's kind of the point of what we're doing.
Exactly.
Too. So reading through these again, you're taken by. I think Kojima does not get enough. He probably does get plenty of credit, but just visually, you're so stunned.
I'm not,
as we referenced before, I'm not a manga expert. I'm not really a fan. By fan, I don't mean that as a negative, like, oh, I'm not a fan of that. But I'm not a fan in terms of one who follows closely.
Right.
So reading Lone Wolf and Cub as someone who does not regularly read manga, there are, at times it's interesting because you have to sort of change the way you read and change the way that you digest what is happening on the page, because it's vastly different in terms of presentation than, you know, the sort of Western style that we're more used to. So it's interesting because it almost becomes, while it's also extremely enjoyable, it's also kind of an intellectual challenge.
Well, yeah. I mean, it has its own visual language that's much different from Western style comics.
Yes.
You know, and yeah, you have to kind of train yourself to read it. You train yourself to read in a different way.
Right. It's like certain writers, like out in the world, I'm not comparing the two, but like if you're going to read like James Joyce or Ulysses or something like that, I know not your favorite piece of work, but I'm just using this as an example of, like, the way to, you have to almost spend the first half hour training yourself to how the language works in Ulysses to sort of really get into then following through with it. And in the same way, it's with Lone Wolf and Cub, is that sort of, that same sort of approach is like, I need to get the rhythm. I need to get how the language is being used, how the movement is being presented within the piece.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, you say you use Ulysses, I would use Derrida as a way, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So in a first pass of Derrida, you'd say, this is nonsense. But you have to train yourself to get into the way he speaks.
Right. Well, and, you know, but some of that comes from the deconstruction, and we're going wildly off topic.
Wow. let's rein it in, people. But it's not as difficult to do that today as I think it would have been back in the 1970s. So if someone from the US or Britain had picked up Lone Wolf and Cub back then, I think it would have blown people's minds. And it did.
It did, actually. Yeah. But there was no precedent at the time, at least in modern times. Even in the 80s, there was at least an existing precedent that readers would have at least a touchstone with.
Yeah, no, today...
Sometimes just watching anime and some of those, you know, anime shows that we would always watch in the afternoons. I'm trying to think now of, like, some of the cartoons.
Yeah, Speed Racer.
Right, Speed Racer. That perfect example is Speed Racer, like, at least trained us a little bit visually to follow along, whereas, yeah, in 1970, there was nothing like that.
Yeah, and the kinetic style. I mean, the way movement is conveyed throughout this comic is stunning.
Which is why, like, I made sure to single out Kojima, because I think, wow, you know, it's the comic is, this could not exist without his visual storytelling.
Oh, absolutely.
It could exist with another artist, but I don't think another artist could have done so well.
Yeah. And the amazing thing is, when you look at this, I mean, all you have to do is watch an episode of Samurai Jack and say, oh, wow, Lone Wolf and Cub is all over this. I mean, just that visual style, like the quick cuts to the face, the long shots, the movement. There's several times there's a movement where one body will pass another, and you just see the two people kind of separated from each other back to back. And there's almost like a beat where you say, well, who got hit? What's going to happen now? And then one will fall to the ground. It's absolutely stunning.
Yeah, and it's a trope, but it's a trope that I think has often been used in recent times because of how it was used in Lone Wolf and Cub.
Yeah, it's a trope, but it's a trope that when done well, it still gets you every time. Because it's used several times throughout just this collection. And every single time I got to there, and I said, I know that Ito is going to be the one standing.
But you're still waiting for it.
Yeah, like, ooh, could it be this time? No.
Clearly, there's, you know, 100 more comics to come after this, so it can't possibly be. But in keeping with that, it should be noted that it's not in our reading material for today, but the last, I believe, to go with the visual nature of this and the duels and how that works, if I wrote this down correctly, because I read it at some point, although it's been a while since I've gone back and... But the final issue or the final vignette or the final part of the series, the duel between Ito and Retsudo or Ogami and Yagyu, I believe, let me look here, it was 178 pages? Am I getting that right? Someone can correct me.
I'm not sure, to be honest with you.
But it's a fight scene that, like, as I was researching this, I wouldn't have even noticed when I was reading the comic how long it went.
Yeah.
But it was like I believe I read 178 pages of just a duel, a fight.
Yeah. It's epic, for sure. And it's been built. Literally, we're going away from just the edition that we're supposed to be reading. But you can't really help that. This is a monumental story that continues to grow and grow and grow, and it slowly feeds you information over that long period of time, so that when you get to that final epic battle, It's meaningful. It has an impact, and it's devastating to read, and to visualize. It's really quite an achievement.
Well, and I think what you like you just mentioned, it's because it's the slow build, and you know, and you referenced this in your intro is you know, the first, this is 9 vignettes I believe collected, the first 7 do not seem to have any connection to one another other than they're just, you know, Ogami shows up and then he kills somebody. Now that is an incredibly simplistic.
Yeah, absolutely. They're little episodes, each one focusing on a mission that they're on.
And so you're reading that. And as you're reading that, it's like there's no interconnectivity that you can spot at the time as you're reading each one individually. But as you continue on,
everything means something.
Everything starts to mean something, particularly when we get to, and if I'm stepping on like your talking points, dial me back here. But as we get to the 8th and 9th installment in that is in this edition, we'll call them the 8th and 9th issues for us Western audiences.
Right.
You start to see what those first 7 stories start to mean. But those first 7 stories stand on their own as just sort of, you know, rogue assassin
who happens to have a little baby with him.
Well,
you know, he's three.
Maybe 3 years, so you know, he's old enough to, like, you know, walk around and pee on people.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is you see him, you're like, oh, he's a 3 year old. He's in danger. I can't believe he's in so much danger. But you find out this 3 year old, he's kind of a danger himself.
He's a bit of a pistol.
A little bit of a pistol.
He's kind of a pistol.
And I love the fact that his baby carriage is basically a rolling armory.
Yeah.
It just comes apart. It's in knives and swords and bows and all kinds of stuff.
And it's metal on the bottom, so it's used as like a shield.
I think Q created that baby carriage for him.
Q?
Yeah, James Bond.
Oh, I had a different Q.
Oh, no. Q from Star Trek?
Q from James Bond.
Q from James Bond, exactly.
My God, how many Qs are there out there?
I don't have a good answer to that.
No, it's rhetorical.
Okay. But yes, those first couple of stories, those first several stories, really amazing. Because Ito himself is sort of a Superman. You know he's not going to lose. Even when he's put in danger, he's not going to lose because he's just too good.
But you don't have context as to why he's so good yet.
Right. But the journey getting to him showcasing how good he is really amazing. There's one, that's the very first story in this, where he has to ride the baby carriage while he's standing on the baby carriage, riding it down a hill while he's holding his son and escaping soldiers. But it's one of the most dynamic action scenes I've ever seen put in comics. It's really quite amazing. But then you find out it's all a ruse. He wanted to get caught.
Right. This is where he gets blinded.
Yes.
Briefly, by the hawk. But he knew that was going to happen. Right. Yeah.
He knew that was going to happen because then he could get.
Then he sent out the letter, basically warning. You know. So it's there's. I'm not going to be good at going into a lot of the Japanese, you know, philosophy. Aspects of this. I am familiar with some of it, but I can't with any kind of expertise or knowledge on the matter. But they reference, right, that this is an actual technique, is to allow yourself to be captured by your enemy to then infiltrate the enemy.
Yes. A lot of this is based on, there's several quotes from Art of War by Sun Tzu.
Mm-hmm.
So he's following, it should be said that Ito has a strict warrior's code that he still follows, even though he's not technically a samurai anymore. Is that how that works? Do you just not become a samurai anymore, or are you a samurai just without a master, and that's what a ronin is? Probably should have looked this up before we started recording.
Well, but I think we're reacting to the comic in terms of what we know, not what we can research.
Exactly. But that does play into the whole, he has a code of honor that he follows, while at the same time kind of pushing the edges of that.
Well, it's a very peculiar code of honor.
It should be said, I guess we should say that, you know, this is feudal Japan, and in a very different culture from what we grew up in. So what is right and wrong, or what we believe to be right and wrong, does not necessarily translate into these stories.
Right. And what Ogami is, so he is set up strictly initially as he is just there to get paid and do one job. And he is not, he does not show an interest in involving himself with the other aspects of the story going on, like the politics, or, you know, again, it's, some bad things are happening to people around him that he does not engage in or interfere in, or, you know, he does not put himself into a protectorate position.
Right.
For those who are not giving him money.
He's not, I'm reluctant to use the term anti-hero, but he's not exactly a hero.
He's not there to solve other people's problems for them.
Right. He's there to take the job, get paid, and move on. Yeah, so as it goes along, it seems as though that's going to be the story. So each little vignette is another mission that he and his son are on. It's very interesting how, in the beginning, it seems as if he's putting his son in jeopardy to gain an advantage or use him to set up a trap. But it becomes clear as the stories continue that he's actually using DeGoro as a partner. He views him as a partner, as someone who's working with him rather than a boy needing protection.
Right. That whole thing gets weird, though. And again, we're attaching a different sensibility to the matter. There's still parts of that where it's just like, where you're like, dude, you're just throwing your son out there. Let me tell you, if this was happening today, you'd have, the health and human services.
Yeah, there'd be social services knocking at your door.
Yeah, social services would be knocking on your metal cart.
Yeah. Excuse me, sir, did you just use your son as bait?
With some paperwork and some questions.
Yeah.
But then again, as we find out later, it's, DeGoro is very much his father's son.
Yes.
And, which we find out later on, it's DeGoro, whether consciously or intellectually chose this path or not, he did choose that path. He chose the sword over the ball.
So that's, that's jumping towards the end.
Right.
That right there, that's a morally questionable scene as well, because he gives a child, a little infant child, the choice between choosing a sword and a ball, choosing childhood or... the life of an assassin. DeGoro eventually does choose the sword so that Ito takes him along on the assassin's road with him. But had DeGoro chosen the ball, Ito would have killed him. That's what's implied there.
Well, it's not even implied. I think it's stated outright.
Well, yeah.
He would send him to a happier life with his mother, who was also dead.
Yes. Yes. But that's kind of awful. And that's not. And here's the thing, that's not the most awful thing that happens in this.
No, it's not. Not even close. I can think of at least two things more awful.
Yeah, there's one that's just it's so awful.
Which occur in the same story.
Yes.
Again, it's the great thing about this is that it pulls it demands that we are pulled out of our sensibilities.
Right.
And I am not advocating for or against. This is not a, it's just a different culture, so it's okay. But it is a different culture. It is a different worldview and life view and philosophical and religious aspect.
And this is, it's a very, very different time. It's not just, it's not just, people were racist in the 40s. No, this is hundreds of years ago. And some of the decisions the characters make, including our titular hero, are really hard to get behind. Mm-hmm. And I think we are so trained nowadays, from superhero culture that, our superheroes are going to do the right thing. Even if they're an, quote unquote anti-hero, they're still doing the right thing.
Yeah, because Wolverine was technically for a long time an anti-hero, but he always had that strong Western moral compass and going to do the right thing. And we're assigning what is the right thing and what is not the right thing.
Yeah. So I think we're put into this position where we see Ito as a superhero type, as someone who's, he's so skilled and so powerful that no one can beat him. So we begin to use that mindset to think of him as the superhero. But then he does things where you say, oh, that's not okay at all.
I'm not okay with this happening.
Yeah. I've been dancing around this, but in one story, might as well just get into it. A woman gets gang raped to death next to him, and he does nothing to help her.
Yes.
Because that's not what he came to do. He had a different mission in mind. Boy, that's a disturbing scene.
It's an incredibly disturbing scene, and it's made even more disturbing by this is the one, the first story, which he is actually not there because he's paid to kill anybody.
Right.
He's there to use the warm springs. He's not there on a job.
Yeah. That's why he at first does not get involved.
And the only time he acts is when he and his son, are actually threatened. He doesn't give a flying doo-doo butt monster to we're keeping the language clean. It's that whole story. It's to me, it's the best story of all of the stories in terms of how it's told and how it's represented. But as you said, it's also the most disturbing. And it is that he only acts, he's not there for money. He is there on a vacation, for lack of a better word. He's there.
Well, he is contracted, eventually at least, contracted to kill the bandits in that town. But apparently it wasn't the right time to strike when that incident was happening.
Right. Yeah. And so therefore not his problem.
Yeah.
When I say literally, I mean literally, he is sitting 4 feet.
Just allowing this to happen. And it is, I was really taken aback by this.
It's horrifically portrayed. And we are supposed to be, I believe, horrified by this.
It's intentional. It's the right writer's intent to make you feel really, really bad when you read this, and he succeeds. Now we could get into there's a real morally, I have problems with this. Let's just say I'm not going to go deep into it because I could rant for quite a while. I don't particularly like that type of story progression.
Right.
But that being said, this was in 1970 and it someone who's actually using,
it was not a trope in comics yet.
No, and this is a writer who knew his history, wasn't shying away from the darker aspects of his own history. And that's to his credit, but at the same time, it's just really, really hard to read.
And equally in that same, I guess if we're going to talk about that, we'll get the other scene out of the way. And maybe this disturbed me more than it disturbed you, I don't know. But in that same story, there is an enforced sexual coupling.
Yes. Yeah. Oh boy.
That is, you know, your life. It's a life or death. And this is where it gets weird because Ogami volunteers at this point.
Yeah.
So a woman is being threatened with death unless she has sexual relations with him. And this is occurring. I'm not speaking to you now, Paul, but to anybody listening. This is occurring, in this town has been taken over by gangsters. So some of the travelers are all sort of corralled into this one building. And so that's where Ogami and Deguro are. It's Chaucer, essentially.
Yeah, that's an excellent.
It's filled with travelers analogy. Of different types. And there's no storytelling, but it's basically, you know, it's Chaucer. It's a very rough scene because the gangsters then are basically have said that if this woman who is a prostitute doesn't sleep with Ogami, then one of them will be killed, if not both. And she initially refuses because, and we're getting into this weird world of honor.
Yeah, and he initially refuses as well.
And because of sort of the concepts of honor that are very foreign, I think, to us here, that we're not talking about the same type of honor we think of here in the West. You know, the gangsters want to watch the two, you know, copulate, have sexy time. And that makes it sound much lighter than it is.
Yeah. But it's actually framed as Ito doing an honorable thing. Like he's making the sacrifice.
He makes the sacrifice to have sex with the prostitute. So to save her life
in front of the tavern of people,
in front of everybody, yeah. The gangsters and the Chaucerian collection of travelers. It's really weird to try to put, so, you know, 30 pages before he watched a woman being raped and killed without raising a finger, and in this situation he has made himself available for a stud fee, basically. It's hard to put those two scenes, both of which are very disturbing, but it's hard to put those two scenes together and get into his head in terms of why he would step in this situation and not step in the other situation.
And it's difficult to rationalize. and it's difficult to get behind him. That being said, he's still a likable character, which is really, boy, that's a feat. Because you still root for him to win in his battles and so forth.
It's weird. I don't know. You said likable. Did you really mean likable? Because
I guess I don't
find him likable. And rereading the whole thing, I don't find him likable. I find his kid likable. Degaro, is likable because he's a 3-year-old kid.
Yeah, maybe it's not.
And he does funny things. He does little funny dances, and he pees on warlords, and whatever.
Yeah.
That's my main takeaway from all of that. By the way,
I guess likable's not the word. He's.
We understand.
We still understand it. We still root for him.
We understand, and we come to understand more later.
Yeah. We're still engaged in his story.
Right. And we want to see don't. Reading these, so the final vignette, the final chapter, we get a piece of the history. The final chapter in this collection, we actually do go back and get a portion of his origin. So we get to understand who the big bad is actually going to be going forward, who we have not experienced yet. And we also get a sense of why he is on the road. But even here, we don't get the actual death of his wife yet.
No, not yet. Well, I find it very interesting that we don't get, because usually you start with the origin story and then you follow the protagonist throughout the story. This,
right.
We're just told, we're just thrown right in. It's basically, you're thrown in media res, where here's the middle of the story and he's already established as who he is. Everyone knows him as Lone, they already have the reputation of Lone Wolf and Cub. And we don't know anything about this person until the very end. Structurally, it's unusual for a story, but it works incredibly well. Because when you finally get those little pieces of revelation about who he is and what his motivations are, it changes how you've just, all the stories you've just read.
Yes.
It's really a great bit of writing.
Yeah.
Something you would not see, especially at that time.
No, not at all.
But hardly now as well. But all this is to say, this is really an artistic achievement.
And that should not be lost in any of this.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, I keep going back to just how it looks. The black and white and the stark black lines on white, on a white background, the violence is visceral.
And very important that it's, like you mentioned, black and white. And, so there's no blood. There's lots of blood, but it's not that it's not that bright red,
it's not gore.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's artistic gore.
You can right. say. Which is actually very affecting. It's because it allows your mind to create what you want to see along with the visuals being represented.
Yes. And just the cinematic scope of the whole thing, the way scenes play out, it's visually stunning. But an amazing part of it is you have these incredible scope and this kinetic fury and this crazy violence, but then it always centers down onto two characters, whether it's Lone Wolf and Cub, or other characters. It's very intimate but grand at the same time.
Wow, that is a really interesting take, and I don't think I noticed that, but as soon as you said that, I'm like going back in my mind and thinking about panels. What a good catch, Paul, because that's like, I'm thinking back and it was like most panels, you have group panels, of course,
right?
But there are so many panels that are just two people. Yeah.
Just individuals connecting with one another.
Right. Whether it be in a fight scene or that's really interesting. And now I want to go back and not do a count, but
this is a series that rewards rereading.
Yes,
because once you get to the end and that and you get some of his backstory, you say, oh well, that changes the perspective of the entire of everything I just read. So you go back and read it again with that in mind, and it changes the story the story grows and becomes enhanced the more times you read it. That's rare in a comic book.
Yeah,
well, storytelling in general.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm fascinated by the concept of, like, you know, the how the panels are populated, which is not something I looked at all on the reading that I did. But now that you bring that up, I'm really curious about panel population.
Like I said, it's intimate and surprisingly tender at times.
You're right. Yeah.
And then suddenly it's furious, frantic action, which is amazing.
Yeah. And it's and there's no quarter given. I mean, it's,
oh, no.
They are very interested in as many forms of death, yeah, as you can get, and as gory and as crazy. I mean, it's batshit sometimes.
Yeah. But it's right? Still real. Yeah, but it is. It's absolutely insane. But it's still
good. It's good batshit.
Yeah, but it's still very stylized. Everyone's movements are precise. A lot of this stuff, you could see it today, and I you know, you could say, oh, this is a trope. Well, it wasn't then. It's a trope because of this, which is stunning to me. I mean, you can see how, look at something like Road to Perdition. That's mm-hmm. basically Lone Wolf and Cub, just set right. in the 1920s. And basically anything
Frank Miller. Well, all of this stuff is Kurosawa at the end of the day, but
yeah. But anything Frank Miller has done, you could just see here. He right. obviously read this and said, oh, I'm going to just do this for the rest of my life and go crazy. But that's different. but this is, you know, it is an artistic achievement, both in writing and mm-hmm. in art. Everything, the whole package is it's an amazing thing. You know, like I said, I'm just starting now in my life to really get into manga and to understand, you know, how brilliant of an art form it is. And like you said in the beginning, it's a new language to learn. It's a new visual yes. medium, and to understand how to, you know, how to read it and how to understand it. It really changes how a lot of my favorite stories are changed because I read this and said, oh, well, now I see their influences, and I see, you know, it gives me a deeper understanding of the things I already love.
Oh, it does. Absolutely. Completely.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess if you haven't read Lone Wolf and Cub, do so immediately.
If you love comics and you got to read Lone Wolf and Cub at least once in your life.
Yeah. Unfortunately, because of the timing, that there's probably going to be a lot of people. It's unfortunate for the reason, but people are probably going to be picking up this.
Right. But that's a good thing. It's yeah. not a good thing that Koke died, but at the same time, it's a good thing in that anything, like any way to get his voice. And again, it's Kojima's art, who I think Kojima died like a long time ago, like, you know, 15 uh-huh. years ago or longer. So, you know, it's believe yeah. the hype. Like if you're seeing stuff out there and you're like, oh, I don't do manga, I don't do. And I'm like, you know, again, I'm not a manga guy either, but you know, it's okay to believe the hype in this situation and not our hype, but believe the hype that you're reading out there as people talk about the importance of these two creators and what they did with the medium.
Yeah, absolutely. This does live up to the hype, and it is. And like I said, it rewards rereading. This is something mm-hmm. you can keep going back to and find new nuances.
And the comic, it's an epic. And, you know, again, not to move beyond like the parameters of just our, you know, the collected edition that we're reading this time, but it is an epic. It is an absolute epic of, and everything ties in as you go along, and things that you read in this first collection come back.
Oh yeah. Everything has a meaning, and even the worst aspects, you know, will tie in. It's a tribute to how well this is written, that this massive epic all does still tie together. It holds together really well, and it has a coherent philosophy throughout. It's a stunning achievement. It really is. Yeah.
And I'm glad that we were able to talk about it. And it was such a great recommendation. And when you first told me that, I was like, how did we not do this before?
Yeah.
how did one of us not do Lone, you know, say, hey, Lone Wolf and Cub?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we're going to, The longer we do this, the more we're going to say, how did we not pick that up? But yeah, but this is an aspect.
Brawl saga yet, you know.
Yeah, but this is a gap in my comic book knowledge, manga that is, and I'm hoping to fill it more and more.
And maybe I'm
going to throw this out there to any of the listeners. If you have any great recommendations for manga, not just the classics. If you have any recommendations, send them our way. Send us to
Twitter. Yes, absolutely.
You know, contact us on Twitter, send us an email, go to our website, collectededitionpodcast.com.
And, because the problem is we probably know a lot of the names. We know the titles, we know some of the creators, yeah. But you know, tell us why we should read them as opposed to us just having a working knowledge of, oh yeah, there's that series, that's whatever, but we haven't read it.
Exactly. So, I have on my list of things.
Not Akira. I assume we both read Akira.
Yeah. And I've read Ghost in the Shell.
Ghost in the Shell. Astro Boy. Right. Stuff like that. You know, those are, you know, obviously things that we've read, and maybe someday we should talk about Akira as well.
We're Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah. You know, so give us something really kind of.
Yeah, but after this, I've just recently read this entire series, mm-hmm. Just gone through the entire thing, and I just started reading Lady Snowblood, and I have Shogun Assassin on my list of reading material. But I'd love to hear, you know, and I'm trying to pick up some various horror comics, manga horror comics, because boy, they're crazy.
Manga horror stuff is rough, though. I've tried to read some of that.
It's brutal. Ooh. So anyway, if you want to hear more about some manga horror recommendations, listen to Long Box of Darkness. That's a really good podcast and friends of the show. Look at that. We're plugging our people.
That's right. A good thing.
Yep. Okay. So I think we've petered out. Next time.
Got to peter out to pay Paul.
Something like that. So next time on an all-new collected edition, we will be reading...
We will be reading DC The New Frontier, the 6-issue limited series written and drawn by the late and very lamented and very much missed Darwin Cook. I know I'm kind of going with like sort of the more cartoony stuff the last several recommendations, and I promise I'll get darker and more independent down the line.
No need to do that. I've been enjoying your recommendations quite a bit,
but we haven't touched on Darwin Cook, and there's so much great work that he did. But I think that in keeping with sort of the Shazam I did the last podcast, I kind of want to do these sort of big, fun, entertaining series. And DC The New Frontier just to me is like it's one of the most entertaining things I've read in a while. So I kind of want to talk about it, and I kind of want to go back to see if it holds up based on my memory of it, because it has been numerous years since I've done it. So
spoilers, talking about, it does.
Yeah. and talking about Darwin Cook is never, ever a bad thing to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. We could have a whole episode just talking about Darwin Cook.
So DC, The New Frontier.
Excellent. That's a great one. Can't wait to read that again.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you everybody for listening. Please, we always love your feedback. So go to our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes or hit us up on Twitter at collectededpod. That's collected ED pod, where I will get back to you.
Me too.
I'm trying to get Brian to tweet more. And he just won't.
The Luddite.
But anyway. Or send us an email too at comments at collectededitionpodcast.com, and I will get back to you because that's what it is. Yes. Anyway, thank you for everyone for listening. We do appreciate your feedback. And if you get a chance, if you listen to us on iTunes, head on over, leave us a review. It really does help us get found. So appreciate it if you did that. Otherwise, till next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at collectededpod, that's collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.